Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Julie from the Underground Group of Philadelphia, PA.
Hi, I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julie.
Can you hear me okay? Put it down. Is that that's better?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. First of all, thanks for the invitation from the group, and also Sarah, thank you for asking me to come out. And my sobriety date is July 15th, 2005. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I feel like this is really loud, but okay. And I take women through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and spend a lot of my time doing that. And I do have the, you know, like the honor to be asked to do stuff like this too, which is really cool. It's probably not my favorite aspect, right? Getting up in front of a group and talking for an hour, but something happens where I don't really have to participate in it anyway, so that's a kind of good. I just tell you guys, as best I can, in a limited period of time, how my life has been completely transformed. That's difficult to do, right? In, you know, 45 minutes, or sometimes it's a half an hour, and I'm like, how do you want me to do that? So I will tell you a little bit about, you know, what my life was like before the going through the work, right, which is what this is all about for me, what it's become all about for me, and this spiritual transformation that took place as a result of that. There's like while I was out there, right, crazy and drinking, and then there's like two parts to that, because then there's when I was in here and I was crazy and not drinking, which in a lot of ways was harder for me. I started down my alcoholic road, probably the day I was born, but we'll just say when I was 11. I grew up in a household where my father wasn't present. He left when I was 2. He drank. He was violent. And my parents got divorced, you know, after 2 years of marriage, and I was a baby. And I don't know why I started putting Kahlua in my milk after school. No one else was doing that. It's not easy to find other kids who actually want to do that, you know, when you're 11. But I can tell you that for the next 18 years, I drank at every opportunity I had. And I drank NyQuil, if that's all that was available. I was the kid who brought NyQuil to sleepaway camp. I was the kid who waited, you know, during sleepovers with children. You know, I was a child, and so I was always waiting for when somebody was going to break out the booze like they did in the movies. You know, Grease was one of my favorite movies, and I, you know, can just remember the sleepaway camp, and the girl was like, hey, 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 and then that never happened, and I was that kid who just wanted to do that, and it wasn't until I was going into my freshman year of high school. That summer, I lived in a shore community, so I was able to drink like I wanted to drink. And I found kids who wanted to drink with me. And so at the age of, I think that was 14, I started blackout drinking. And started high school with a new nickname and humiliation and no way of dealing with it except for to continue to drink. It's the first summer that I was escorted home by the police, right? And I will tell you that this one particular night towards the end of the summer, it was the night I was brought home by the police because the people who I was hanging out with actually called the police on me to get me out of their house. I said, I don't remember a lot of that night. I don't remember a lot of that summer. I know I spent a lot of time with my girlfriend standing on the corner. And it wasn't like we were waiting for people to approach us. We were flagging down cars, yelling at guys in cars and getting in with them and going wherever they were going as long as they were drinking. So I'm very lucky, and I know that today. Back then, I thought nothing bad could happen. You know, I really was delusional about my safety. So that's how I spent the summer, and I wind up, you know, being brought to my mother's home, and I had a moment where I remember saying to her, "I drink every day, and I can't stop," and I knew that to be true, because even back then, I was different than my friends. Like, they would stop, and I wasn't. They would want to go home, and I wouldn't. I would do things like sleep on porches or walk the boardwalk all night or, you know, whatever. I just couldn't go home. I just didn't want the party to be over, and that's what it looked like. My mother had absolutely no idea what she was up against, nor did I, right? And so the next morning, I remember waking up, coming to, whatever you want to call it, and there was like blue, looked like plastic on the floor next to the bed, which was the contents of my stomach, and I had to paint something at the house. That was like what I had to do, and then I was, you know, in trouble, grounded, whatever. And she tried to control my drinking. You know, she tried to keep me in. And I didn't understand. And this went on for years and years, you know, until I left that house when I was 17 and went to live with my grandparents because I thought that that would be a solution. What I didn't understand was when she would try to separate me from alcohol, I acted like an animal. I would break things, throw things, scream, yell, have like a breakdown. And I thought it was because I wanted to go out and have fun. I didn't know that she was taking away the only thing that was my solution at that time. The only thing that made it okay, what I had done the weekend before. The only way I could face my friends and my peers. Because I just was so uncomfortable in my own skin. So it was a long time before I thought I had social anxiety, you know. I thought a lot of things. I spent a lot of time in therapy, right? Shortly thereafter, I was put into therapy. You know, I would sit there and I would, this went on for, 10, 12 years. I would sit in front of these poor people and cry. And it would be my show, you know, for an hour. And I would never tell them the truth. You know, and I couldn't stop what I was doing, couldn't stop drinking. And so fast forward, you know, to me, 29 years old or whatever, and I am unable to work. I am unable to have relationships, the most important relationships in my life. My grandparents, who really raised me on and off for a lot of my life, because as I said, my father left, my mom was on her own, and so my grandparents took us in, and they parented me. While my mom went to school and she worked, I only started drinking when we had gotten our own place. This was the first time we had our own place. And then at 17, I got kicked out of my mom's house after she got remarried and she had children. And she couldn't, you know, she couldn't deal with me not coming home at night because she had a baby to raise. And I understand that today. And actually, it was my choice. She really didn't kick me out. It was my choice. I left. I was in a lot of trouble in school. So I left and I went to live with my grandparents. And my grandmother did a lot of praying while I lived with her. And she gave me a lot of freedom. And she said, you have to make your own mistakes. Like, I can't stop you from making your own mistakes. But she did say to me in a letter, because she wrote a lot of letters, I know you don't always tell me the truth. And it's because you're not proud of it. Someday, that will be different. She also used to write, to thine own self be true. She was a very, very important person in my life. She also wished for me the gift of faith, and she would tell me that. And it would be a long time before I understood what that meant, you know, before I understood. And she didn't talk a lot about God, and she didn't talk a lot about religion. She was pretty liberal, actually, you know. She was Catholic, but, you know, she had a pretty open mind about things, and I just felt very safe there. I felt like when I was there, I was home. And I will tell you that I had a lot of respect, you know, for her and for her home. And I would go away to do my dirt. And so after having spent a year at her home, I was asked to leave. And I went on my way. And so fast forward, you know, to this point where I have drunk myself into joblessness, homelessness, and without a relationship with her. And I'm suicidal, and I don't know what to do, and I wind up in AA, and that was not my plan. I had tried to stop drinking on my own quite a few times, and I once made it 9 months with no drinking. And I had a substance abuse counselor and a mentally ill, it was a mentally ill, chemically addicted program that I was a part of. And I had medication, and what happened there was that I didn't feel anything. I had no feelings. So I didn't stay sober, though. You know, I went out for a birthday of a friend of mine, and within an hour I had a drink in my hand and other things, and I didn't come home for 2 days, right? So unsuccessful attempts at staying separated from alcohol, and I really didn't think that AA was going to work because I'd gone to a few meetings, you know, and there wasn't a magic wand that someone tapped me on the head and I never drank again. Like, that didn't happen. So I figured AA didn't work. But I wind up in AA and I'm hanging around for a while and I'm not drinking. And it's literally don't drink, go to meetings one day at a time, AA. And so I'm going to 3 meetings a day, right? Because I was told to. And time goes by, and I'm in AA. You know, I'm here for like 2 years, and I am sicker than I was when I walked in. And I don't know why, because I have a job, right? Separated from alcohol, I was able to get a job. I no longer feel like I'm behind glass when I'm talking, right? Because I can remember coming in and thinking, I'm speaking. They have no idea what I'm saying. like, I would be talking, and it was literally like, they don't hear me. I can't. I'm not making sense. Like, I wasn't forming sentences. And I don't know what's wrong with me, because everyone else seemed to be okay. And I'm in this place where I don't even belong here anymore. And not to mention that I have an assault charge, right? I'm acting and I'm chasing a paycheck, job to job, money. I need money. I need the apartment. I need the car. I got into a crazy relationship, right? And I'm sick and I'm really, really not well. And I have to go to court for an assault charge, right? Like, that's not sobriety. It looks like it did when I was drinking, but I'm sober. Or I'm not drinking, right? So I was told that if you help someone, you will stay sober. So I go to this detox meeting where this woman shares that she doesn't have a place to live. And so I said, you can come and live with me. You come live with me, and I'm going to stay sober, and I'm going to help you, and, you know, that's going to work. And so she's with me, and I'm driving her to IOP, and I am driving her to and from IOP, and I'm taking her to meetings, and we, at the end of the night, would sit and talk. And so about 2 weeks into this, two or three weeks into this, she looks at me and she said, well, now what? And I said, I have taken you as far as I can. which was back and forth to IOP into a meeting. And I said, I think you need to find someone who can help you. And I really thank God for that, because I didn't fake it. You know, I could have hurt her. So I didn't, I you know, let her go, and she actually wound up doing fine, but I was still left with me. And I show up at this conference in New Jersey, and I had finally started praying for a teacher, right? Because I'm not deaf. I hear in meetings, get a sponsor, go through the work, but I didn't do that because it was like asking a woman to go to the prom with me, you know, and I didn't know how to talk to women. I really didn't. A choice few, you know, I would talk to. So I show up at this conference, and this woman is standing in front of me, and she has peace. And I can see it. And I looked at her and I said, I'm dying. I'm in AA and I am dying. And I'm either going to put a gun in my mouth or I'm going to drink. And she said to me, well, I take women through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you ever been through the work? Have you been through the steps? And I said, no. No, I have not. But I'm really interested in doing that. And she said very clearly to me what this was going to be, and that it would be my priority, that it would be her priority, and that we would go through the first 164 pages as it's outlined. And she really laid out the expectations for me so that it wasn't a surprise, you know, that if I canceled or if I, you know, tried to BS my way out of something, that she was going to hold me accountable. And she also had this way about her where she didn't cut me off to get out what she needed to say. She, like, listened to me, and that I had never really watched anybody actually do that. I'm sure other people have, but, like, I wanted what she had because she was peaceful. And she, like, slowed me down, you know, because I was one of those alcoholics. I was, like, burning the candle at both ends all the time. And I wanted what she had. And so she sat down with me and she started talking to me about what it meant to be a real alcoholic. She explained to me that I have, you know, of course, a physical allergy, which was not hard for me to understand. Based on my experience, I understood, okay, that's clearly an issue. I drink, you know, it's like that's what happens. She explained that on my own, I could not stay stopped. And then we looked back based on my history of what that looked like, you know, in my drinking. This inability for me to not go back to drinking. That drinking was my solution. And that's why my life was so unmanageable now, was because I didn't have something to take its place. And she scared me. It scared me. It was the truth. Like, I was finally looking at what the truth was, and it didn't look pretty to me, right? And then we looked at my life and how unmanageable it was. Clearly, going to court is not what you want to be doing when you're sober, right? So I've gone through the work a couple times, you know, since that first time through. And I love that we read the set-aside prayer before the meeting, because each and every time I go through the work and every time I take a woman through the work, we say that prayer. And it's been a different experience each and every time, right? So I'm going through the work again, where I'm getting a deeper understanding of what Dr. Silkworth did for us when he put his career on the line and said, I can't help these real alcoholics, right? And that one alcoholic working with another is what works, because they've walked in my shoes. I've walked in their shoes. It's, we can't transfer something we haven't got. Like, I need a spiritual transformation, and I've gone to doctors, and they're great. And I'm not saying that we don't need them, but what I'm saying is they can't take my hand and put it in God's hand, right? So each and every time I sort of go back through and re-look at this book, it comes alive in a different way, right? And so the first time it's physical allergy, mental obsession, life unmanageable. And this time it's, if it wasn't for this man, I wouldn't be standing here. And the depth and weight in that, you know? I mean, it would really moved me. And understanding what a spiritual transformation means now, somewhat, you know, I don't know if we'll ever really get that, right? It's beyond words. You know, this relationship that we get to have with God and with the world of the Spirit, it's beyond words. But to get a glimpse of it and to understand that someone back in 1939 was willing to put their career on the line for us, and to point out that this is what we need in order to live, well, it catapults me once again into step two, right? To really, you know, the first time around when I'm like, having this relationship with God, I don't know what that means. I don't know what that looks like, right? I've never had a relationship with God before. So it was just yes. You know, the answer was yes. Is God everything or is he nothing? Okay, You know, I mean, yes, well, it has to be because I don't want to die, right? And so this transformation continues to happen, and it's like, you know, my teacher this time around said to me, because I showed up pretty mangled again, you know, not thinking about drinking, right, this time through the work, but I was going through a divorce. The endings of a divorce. I was losing a home. I was lost two people who were very important to me. My grandparents both passed away, and one right after the other, unexpectedly. And so I showed up to my teacher, my sponsor, and I was pissed because that's not what I thought should be happening. Because I'm doing what I should be doing, right? It's crazy. But that's what I thought, you know, like I'm doing the deal. Why is my life, you know, why am I going into foreclosure? You know, why am I broke? This shouldn't be happening. And like I'm railing against it. And she said to me, because you think you're serving something that lives outside of you. She said, but what you once you understand that God is in here, deep down within, everything will change. And I was like, I mean, blew my mind, you know? So I sat with that in meditation and in prayer and was like, and she's right. Because fast forward 6 months down the line, everything is different. Everything has changed. It's different the way I am. The relationship that I have with my Creator is deeper. It has more meaning. But more importantly, my relationship with you has changed. Because I was railing at that time against some resentments and some life circumstances because I was looking through my own eyes. And what she said to me was, I have a dog. So she has these great stories, these great analogies. I have a dog. I don't have children, so the closest thing I have to a child in me actually is. His name is Handsome. He's a small chihuahua. She said to me, because some things had happened that weren't great. You know, sometimes things happen. People are asleep. They do things in our lives, and they suck, you know? But I couldn't let go of it, right? And it was making me sick. And she said, you know, along with God is here, deep down within, you have to be able to see it in other people. And so what she said to me was, Handsome, if Handsome didn't feel well and you went to pick him up and he bit you because he was sick, would you kick him? Would you scream at him? Would you, you know, be angry with him? And I was like, no, of course not. He's sick. And she said, well, that's the way God sees you. And that's the way you need to see other people. You have got to see people through God's eyes, not through your own, because your perspective is way off. And that's why you feel like crap. And again, like this second step experience is, it just grows, right? And the book comes alive again, right? And it's a different experience. It's a deeper experience this time through. So, you know, I need to have that. It's vital, right? For me, I can't stay in one place for too long. Because I get, I don't know, bored. I don't know what it is, but there's something inside of me that's like, we need something new, or life happens and I get, you know, and my feet get cut out from under me and I'm like, what the heck? And like, now it's time to grow. You know, you sat around for like 3 months or whatever, and now here's another one, you know, and it gets to the point. It's gotten to the point for me where it's like, bring it on, man. Like what, you know, like bring it on. I'm okay. Like I know without a doubt, no matter what happens in my life, I know I'm going to be okay. And if you had told me that, I would have, at this point in my life, gone through what I've gone through these past couple of years and be able to stand in front of you and say, like, I am free. And not only am I free, but I'm, like, happy. I would have never believed you. There's no way I would have thought that I could have gone through what I've gone through and still be standing. But it's because of that shift in perspective, right? I need that shift in perspective. And that came for me this time, not only through a new teacher, but also working with the third step prayer like I had never worked with it before. Because I didn't understand when I first went through it. I thought it was about getting rid of my stuff, like, so that I was free, right? But the third step now has transitioned into, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self so that I can better do thy will. Take away my difficulty so that victory over them bear witness to those I would help. Right? I never got that. I didn't get that for years. I was like, what? Wait. And so I was sitting in meditation with this because my teacher, you know, my sponsor has me sit in, you know, meditation. I do that now. It's regularly. It's a part of my day. And so I'm sitting with it, and I was like, oh, my God, this prayer is not about me. It's not about making my life easier. It's about the women who are going to come into my life who are going through divorce, who are going through the grieving process, who are going through, you know, foreclosed a home, who are going through the loss of a job. Like, free me from the bondage of self so that I can bear witness to them that they can get through it sober and free. And God changes everything, right? And so we bring this new attitude into our workplace. We bring it into our new relationships. We bring it into, like, our friendships. And everything changes. But I wouldn't be awake to it if I didn't continue to do the inventory process, right? Which is where I get to see the truth. Which is where my delusion, right, gets magnified. One of my very first resentments was my father. And, you know, it just wasn't a part of my life. And I blamed him for a lot of stuff, and a lot of that would come. If you saw me and I was not drinking, I would have told you that everything was fine. But when I was drinking and it was late at night and I was drunk and you asked me about my father, you better buckle in for quite an evening. Because it would wind up with me in the corner crying in a ball on the floor or punching my TV or, you know, destroying my own apartment for no reason because I was angry, you know. And so what the inventory process, especially the third column and the fourth column, what it did was it showed me how this resentment against my father, there were mistakes made. No doubt I was a child. But as a grown woman, carrying that resentment into all of my relationships with men meant that each man was treated as a suspect. And I always had a bag packed. Because I'm leaving you unless you beat me to the door. You know what I mean? This abandonment stuff and all of that, you know, I blamed him for. What happens for me with these resentments is that I get a really good look at myself, and then the resentment turns into compassion, right? That's what that four-step prayer is about. And again, a new perspective, a new eye, new eyes to see that I am my father's daughter. And that if I had a child, you better believe I would have been out the door because, number one, I would have stepped over that baby to go drink. And number two, I wouldn't have been able to show up as a parent, and that would have nearly killed me, right? And so my resentment turned into compassion. And it also changed the way I conducted myself in relationships. And I need the inventory process and a really good teacher to point that out to me, is how these resentments, you know, and these areas of self just manifest and manifest again and again and again. Because you could have put anybody in front of me, and that relationship would have never worked out. And so I get to see my character defects, right, as a result of that. And I am, and I wouldn't do that if I didn't continue to take inventory, right? Because, you know, I get handed a list by some sponsors with a list of, you know, these are your character defects. And number one is always judgment, right? I'm always judging. It's always going on in here, and, like, I need to be free from that. And I need to be able to go out and set right the wrongs. You know, I need to be able to be free. And if I have amends that I haven't made, I'm not free. If I have forgiveness that I haven't granted to someone else, I'm not free. You know, if I hadn't gone to my grandparents and made amends to them, I wouldn't have been able to go with them on one of their very last vacations. I mean, they were my parents. And I was able to share the last, you know, 8 years of their life with them, 7 years of their life with them, and to show up. And when I got the call about my grandmother, it wasn't about how is this going to affect me. It wasn't about what am I going to do without her. It was, and I remember driving to the hospital and thinking, it's my worst nightmare. This is it. I mean, this is it. This is as bad as it's going to get. And I remember driving to the hospital and thinking, this isn't happening. And there was something in my mind that said, yeah, it is happening. And I thought about my grandfather. You know, they'd been married for 63 years. And I thought about my mom. And I just thought, God, I hope I get there in time. And I did. And so I show up, and my grandfather, she had had an aneurysm in her sleep. And my grandfather was heartbroken, and he didn't know what to do because they said, well, we could operate, but she might not make it, and she's never going to be the same. One half of her brain wasn't even responsive. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know what to do. And I said, let's go pray, because I don't know what to do either. So this program and God has given me the ability to take my grandfather by the hand and just bring him somewhere where he can be with God. Because I don't have any answers. And I was able to sit with him while he sat there and just be with him. And I was able to be with my grandmother as she took her last breath. And I was able to, 20 days later, when my grandfather said, I am out of here. He said, I miss her, and I want to go. And I said, I'm so excited for you. Please give her a hug for me. It's going to be great, you know? And I got to be with him as he transitioned. I got to tell him how much I love him and that I'm okay and that everybody's okay. It was actually, I was sitting with him because he wasn't supposed to die at this time, but I was sitting with him and he was not really communicative. He was brought back to the house and he was on hospice, and I was sitting there telling him where everybody was. I said, Joan is in the kitchen and she's making such and such, and John is out at the bank and he's taking care of some of the affairs. I said, everything here is okay. And I'm so excited for you. And I could tell, because I had seen it, I could tell what was happening. And shortly after he passed away, I heard something inside of me. Because at this time in my life, I kept very, very close to God and meditation. And something said to me, you need to go upstairs and sit. And, you know, the family was coming in, and I went upstairs in their old bedroom, and this is the first time that anything like this has ever happened to me, and I sat, and within, like, a minute, I see these two sparkling lights dancing in front of me, and I knew, you know, the world of the spirit was there. My grandparents were there, and they were letting me know that they were okay, and it wasn't a hallucination. Like, it was happening, and I was so, and the tears are coming, and I was like, I would have missed this. Like, if I hadn't had a teacher and had God in my life and had this program, I would have been somewhere feeling sorry for myself, and I would have missed this. And I wouldn't have been able to go to my mom and hold her hand, because she lost her parents. You know, amazing, amazing things. So, like, through this process, like, the world of the spirit, like, I thought I understood a little bit about that, man. I had no idea, right? And so the relationship with my grandparents is not over. It's still very much a part of my life, you know? And to know that, like, I wouldn't have known that. You know, I would have missed out on that. And one of my sponsors, because I'm very close to all of the women who have taken me through the work, and one of my sponsors said to me, and we weren't working together anymore, she said, but Julie, just wait, because other women are going to be brought into your life. Because my grandmother was everything. Like, I talked to her every day. And now I have new women in my life who have, like, different aspects of her, right? And I can go and talk to this one about that, and I can go and talk to, you know, another girlfriend about relationship questions. I don't have those, but someday, you know, I might. Or like job or whatever, you know, I mean, and she's still very much here. And I do believe that she has put these women in my life, you know? So meditation, prayer, continuing to do this. About 2 years ago, I got a letter from my father. And I was in shock. And he said, I've been looking for you. I have 2 years sober. And I mean, I really thought that he was not going to live. You know, I thought the next time I heard about him would be that he was no longer here. Just because, you know, he was in his 50s, you know, reaching 60. And if he drank like I drank, which I know he did, I don't know how he would have made it. But I got this letter from him, and my grandmother was still alive. So I immediately called her, and she said, you have got to go see him. My grandmother was always an advocate of his, you know, because he played the guitar by ear. He plays a lot of instruments by ear. And she always had a soft spot for him. And instead of me going to see him, it was exactly this time 2 years ago, he was at my doorstep. And before he got there, he said, what do you want me to do? Well, what do you want to do while I'm there? And he said, you know, I can only stay for a short time because he has a family in New Hampshire. So I can come right before Christmas. And I said, I want to listen to you play. That's what I've always, always wanted, was to just listen to my father play the guitar. And so he said, sure. And so we got there, and he didn't play the first night. We went out to eat, and now he's like newly sober, And he doesn't go through the steps, and that's okay. He plays, and you know, he goes to church and he plays in the choir there, and hey, it's cool. Like I don't care. You know, it's none of my business. But you're here, you know, and so he's kind of shy, and he's got, you know, suspenders and a flannel shirt, and he's got like his guitar and a banjo and like a ukulele. Like he's brought everything with him. And so the first night I kept waiting, and I realized that he really is shy. And so the next morning I'm upstairs getting ready for our day. I'm in the bathroom, and all of a sudden I start hearing it. You know, I hear him start strumming a few chords, and I hit the floor. Because I just couldn't believe that this was happening in my house, you know? Like, my dad is downstairs. I knew it was a miracle. I knew that it was a miracle. And so I went to visit his family last Christmas. His new family. Oh, thanks. Not his new family, my new family, right? And he's got three kids, and they're not. So here's the thing: like I can look at that situation and say, I was spared because they're in their 20s, and they were there. And so when I got to sit down with them, immediately we got rid of him. Like, we got rid of Dad. He had to get ready for a Christmas pageant and, like, put his outfit on or whatever. And we sat down at dinner, and there was no small talk. It was immediately about alcoholism and what they had survived and what they went through and the questions that they had. And I love them. You know, there was this instant connection, this instant, like, connection to these kids. And I know what they went through because I was my father. You know, I know what they survived. And so I got to talk to them about what real alcoholism is. And I got to tell them that it wasn't what he wanted to be. That if he could have done better, he would have done better, and now he has a chance. So he's still sober, right? And I have a new family, like this whole other side of the family, and I have also peace. And this never would have. I would be dead. Like, this is a miracle. Like, the fact that I'm here, and that, you know, bad things happen in life. But you get through enough of them sober, and you're like, whatever. You know, I know it's not all going to be, you know, wine and roses, for lack of a better term. Like, it's not all sunshine and hearts and all of that kind of stuff. It's like, this is real life. But I can get through life sober, happy, free. I can be of service to other people, like in my job or anywhere, like taking women through the work, women who have never experienced this, and saying to them, like, we've only scratched the surface, right? I've only scratched the surface. Like, there's so much more to this, and it's so exciting, right? Because once you get to that 11th step, and my first teacher was really careful about me staying close to the big book and close to the work so that I'm not confused about where this power is coming from, right? It's coming from here, because I had like a bookshelf full of, you know, all kinds of really cool stuff. And she said, I don't want you to read any of that right now. I want you to be clear about what's working. She said, there'll be a time for that. And so it was straight big book, right? And it's always in addition to the big book, but never instead of, right? It's always going back to basics, always going back to the mechanics of what worked. But now there's also, like, like different kinds of meditation, going to Buddhist temples, you know, looking into all different kinds of religion and ceremonies and the moon and, you know, whatever you're into, whatever gets you closer and you feel it within your soul and like this whole, you know, fourth dimension of existence, like it's continuous learning, like it's continuing to grow, it's continuing to like, I mean, I feel sometimes like my head has been like notched off and just anything is possible, right? Because I always came from this place of lack. I always came from this place of, well, there's not enough. There's not enough happiness to go around, so I need to get mine before you get yours. Or there's not enough good jobs to go around, so I need to get my job and not worry about you. And like, you know, all of this lack of abundance, right? And what I've learned is like, there's more than enough. There's more than enough. This world is abundant. And what I give, I get. So anything I'm keeping from you, I'm actually keeping it from myself. Right? And that this whole thing is about service. It's all about what I can give. And in return, I get so much. This is telling me that I have pretty much reached the end. I do want to say thank you once again, Sarah. I want to thank the group. And happy holidays. That's all I have. Thank you.